acted upon by the United Nations and by other institutional mechanisms to bring this crime to an end.
Well, Professor Falk, very quickly, before we conclude, can you say what you expect to happen? What's the effect of this report, given that the UN has already distanced itself from it?
We have 10 seconds.
The Secretariat has distanced itself. Other organs of the UN haven't responded, so far as I know. Our hope is that this report will lead to a careful inquiry by appropriate organs of the UN, and that if our analysis is persuasive, that it will have some political consequences.
Richard Falk, we want to thank you for being with us, joining us from Edinburgh, Scotland, co-author of the report, Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ballot Measure 57, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law for nonviolent property crimes, accounts for nearly half the women serving prison time in Oregon. And as Oregon legislators consider opening a second women's prison, a new report, Unlocking Measure 57, explains how the development of Oregon criminal laws over the last few decades has widened the net of defendants receiving mandatory minimum sentences for property offenses. The report calls on Oregon lawmakers to repeal Measure 57. Hear the report on Prison Pipeline, March 20th at 6:30 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the White House's so-called America First budget blueprint was released today. It includes vast cuts to social programs in favor of military and border spending.
Democrats in Oregon have a plan to push paid family leave through the state legislature.
And Portland International Airport was just named the country's most stress-free airport for the second year in a row.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 16th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The White House budget proposal released this morning aims to, quote, zero out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, known as the CPB, among other agencies and programs. The CPB is a private nonprofit that uses government money to, most famously, provide support to PBS and NPR, but the bulk of its funding goes to public broadcasting stations. According to a statement from PBS, public television is America's largest classroom, with approximately 68% of all kids between the ages of 2 and 8 watching and learning from shows like Sesame Street, Thomas and Friends, Arthur, and a lot of other shows, too. PBS also operates web resources for teachers that are used by over 1 million educators to teach as many as 40 million students in K through 12 classrooms. There are also some 23,000 people working in public broadcasting across the United States, many at small town and rural radio and television stations. Speaking on MSNBC on Thursday, Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said that cutting public broadcasting was in the best interest of rural and inner city Americans. He also specifically pointed to the Department of Defense, to Homeland Security, and to the border wall as preferred programs under this budget proposal.
KBOO is one of thousands of community radio stations that receive CPB funds. To help clarify the role of federal funding at KBOO and how it differs from other stations, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with the station's development director, Becky Myers.
In terms of KBOO specifically, how are these cuts as proposed, how would they hit KBOO?
What it means for KBOO, we are fortunate and have cultivated, I think, a very good separation between federal money and our operating expenses. KBOO is mostly funded by member support and private foundations and underwriting rather than CPB. For us, in being in Portland, which is a major market, and having our member support be the basis of our operations, that puts us in a very fortunate place as opposed to our comrades at the National Federation for Community Broadcasting, which include rural stations and single service frequencies that are the only public radio in specific area or whatever. We aren't necessarily, we don't depend on CPB in a way that our colleagues do.
They say they want to zero out the CPB. What did it ever do to them? What's their anti-CPB argument?
Yeah, that's
or the general.
Yeah, I ask that question too. What did Big Bird do to you? Really? Come on. To explain a few things, CPB has a 2-year appropriation. And so in 2016, Congress had made the appropriation for CPB for 2017 and 2018. And so zeroing out what CPB has now and for the next year is, it sort of undermines the public interest in that way specifically, that money had already been earmarked for use in public broadcasting, which includes TV and radio. And I think a lot of it goes to TV stations and, show development and things like that. And that seems to me to be the strangest thing. This was already, the check was written. Are you asking for the check back?
Yeah.
That's sort of what's happening. And also, CPB has been under fire many, many, many times since its founding almost 50 years ago. It seems that it comes from a very select group of people and perhaps in the sort of neo-fascist, we're going to get rid of all of this art type stuff so that we can really focus on diverting the money to places like the military where we can more easily pocket it. That may be the case. And a lot of people on both sides of the aisle do value public media, and they do value PBS, community stations, NPR, all of the people that are creating a public media within, the sort of public agreement, that public trust that this sort of communication ensures. I do want to point out that, while KBOO may be in a fortunate position and that our colleagues in rural areas are sort of, more susceptible to the defunding of CPB, I think that we should take a look at this as a directed attack against the First Amendment. That, to me, is sort of the crux of what the issue is with this defunding. Not so much that, there's no use for public media, that it can be fully funded by individuals, but more that it has the tags of being progressive and being liberal and all of this sort of negative thing, or the negative understanding that the far right has of media in general.
I have been speaking with Becky Myers, KBOO's development director. Thank you for talking to us, Becky.
Absolutely.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And this same budget also proposes cutting the Corporation for National and Community Service, which finances AmeriCorps. This program was created in 1993 under the Clinton administration to address our nation's challenges through service. Over 5 million people have served in AmeriCorps, Senior Corps, the Social Innovation Fund, and the National Volunteer Effort. Primary focus areas for the service include disaster relief, education, environmental stewardship, healthy communities, economic opportunities, and veteran affairs. AmeriCorps members receive a living stipend during their service and an educational award upon completion of their term that can be used to repay student loans or can be applied to future studies. Currently, resolutions in both the House and Senate are circulating to recognize the importance of AmeriCorps and to promote participation in national and community service. Locally, AmeriCorps members can be found throughout the city with Jesuit Volunteer Corps, Food Corps, the Confluence Environmental Center, and Habitat for Humanity. Today's budget proposal would remove funding and manpower for AmeriCorps, greatly affecting all of those programs by abolishing the Corporation for National and Community Service.
After successes with paid sick leave and raising minimum wage during the last two legislative sessions, this year Oregon Democrats are sponsoring a paid family leave bill. House Bill 3087 would set up a statewide family and medical leave insurance fund. The fund would give employees up to 12 weeks of paid leave to care for themselves or a family member, plus an additional 6 weeks upon the birth or adoption of a child. Employees would be paid about 90% of their wages while on leave. The program is essentially a payroll tax. 0.5% of every worker's pay would be routed to the fund, and employers would match the amount. A worker making $60,000 would bring home $25 less per month. Currently, most Oregon employers are required to give workers 1 week of paid sick leave, and workers can get up to 12 weeks of family leave, but without pay. Only three states, California, New Jersey, and Rhode Island, require paid leave and medical leave.
A Montessori school in Northeast Portland's Alameda neighborhood has reported 7 cases of E. coli, with 6 of the cases being children and one of them an adult. This is following 2 previous cases of E. coli in Clackamas. This is part of an ongoing outbreak that has led to at least 16 illnesses nationwide. The culprits appear to be I Am Healthy Soy Nut Butter and I Am Healthy Granola. Both of these are products of Soy Nut Butter Company, which has issued a voluntary nationwide recall earlier this month. People with this brand are urged to either throw it out or return to the store where they bought it, regardless of any best used by dates. Dr. Jennifer Vines, a Multnomah County Deputy Health Officer, stated that we are working closely with families, staff, and school administrators to stop the spread of this infection and understand how this outbreak happened. The products are thought to have not been consumed within the classroom, but at a student's home. Symptoms can occur up to 10 days after exposure, and children showing any symptoms of vomiting or diarrhea should, of course, not attend school. For any questions regarding this outbreak, the Multnomah County Health Department of Communicable Disease Services team can be reached at 503-988-3406.
Money magazine has named Portland International Airport as the most stress-free flight hub in the United States for the 2nd year in a row. J.D. Power's review for Money gave the airport its highest satisfaction score among major airports based on top marks for customer satisfaction and on-time arrivals. It noted that PDX is small enough that travelers don't have to take trams, and it's easy to find baggage handling areas. The airport offers free Wi-Fi, diverse shopping, and quality watering holes. At PDX, you can buy a Big Mac for under $5 and watch a movie in between flights. The closest competitors were Salt Lake City and Tampa International. Money called PDX a, quote, slam dunk.
A student at a Vancouver, Washington middle school was allegedly attacked by another student because she is transgender. In a Facebook post, the student's aunt claims that she is, quote, the victim of hate crimes every day. This is at McLaughlin Middle School. According to the post, both students and teachers have habitually and deliberately singled out the student for bullying, including using her birth name, referring to her as he, and making lewd comments in class and in the hallways. The incident that prompted the post from her aunt involved a physical attack from a male student that left her with a bloody nose. The aunt claims the school did not discipline the offender because, quote, 3 students claimed that my niece pushed the male student first. In a statement to the Columbian newspaper, a spokeswoman for McLaughlin Middle School said the school did take disciplinary action against the male student, but did not comment further because of privacy laws.
The White House proposal to reshape health insurance will be a disaster for Oregon, according to an analysis that Governor Kate Brown ordered from state health and insurance agencies. Under the proposed American Health Care Act, as many as 465,000 Oregonians would lose health coverage by 2023, including 80,000 next year. Oregon would lose $2.6 billion in federal funding. The uninsured rate would triple from 5% to more than 15% and continue to rise. The report comes just days after an assessment from the Congressional Budget Office found that coverage would decline across the U.S. by 24 million over the next 10 years. It also forecast a $337 billion reduction in the federal deficit.
Today, KBOO News Director Zelos Marchant sat down with Venus Hayes, whose son Quinice was killed last month by Portland police, and with Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot PDX. Here is some of that conversation.
The case of Quinice Hayes, the black 17-year-old fatally shot by East Precinct officer Andrew Hurst, has followed a trajectory that mimics a familiar chronology for communities of color demanding justice for their children who have lost their lives at the hands of police officers on duty. Over 4 weeks have passed since Quinice Hayes' mother, Venus Hayes, has been allowed to see her son, and in that time, she has fought for the indictment of Officer Andrew Hurst. Quinice Hayes is Officer Hurst's second federal hearing involving a fatal shooting. I sat down with Venus Hayes and Teresa Rayford this afternoon to talk about Quinice's viewing and how an indictment would create positive change for not just her family, but for Portland. This is Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
Venus, thank you so much for joining us. And we have in the studio Venus Hayes and Teresa Rayford. And also behind me a couple really cute chillins of Venus's. We have Prince and Adonis.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come speak with us. I understand today is Quinice's viewing, and you're going to be able to go to that.
Yeah, we're trying to schedule it in the evening so all family members can attend.
That's really wonderful to hear that you'll finally be able to see him. How are things? I mean, apart from the obvious, how are you doing?
I have a lot to hang on to. You know, I have Quinice was the oldest of five siblings, so I still have four other children that depend on me day to day. So I'm trying to hang in there.
I don't think there's no words really, you know. But before we met, I'd spoken to Teresa earlier in a different story, and all of us here at the station just want you to know that our feelings and our prayers are with you, our thoughts are active for us that are depending on you. Why don't we talk about the indictment that. And I want to make sure that everyone who is not aware of the story and where we're at knows what's going on. I think most people in Portland now are aware of Quinice and what has happened and what we're fighting for, but I don't think everybody really is on the same page about the details. Mm-hmm. So what has happened up till now, and what are you hoping to accomplish going forward?
The only thing that's happened now is the like only small achievement that I can say that really happened so far in the case is that the grand jury will be transcribed. It's not really a victory because that's the usual practices. Mm-hmm. And most officer involved shooting, so I don't know. I thank God for small things, you know. At this point, we hoping for an indictment of Officer Andrew Hurst. I should also mention that this is not Officer Hurst's first fatally involved shooting. You know, my son is the second in a total of 4 years out of a 7-year career on the police force. So that speaks volumes. You know, most officers go their whole career, were never discharging a weapon. And you have this guy who's this is his second time being involved in a fatal shooting, you know. So at this point, we're hoping for an indictment. We need community support. Anybody who, you know, want to stand behind the family and work with us, you know, I'm open to all help.
Important detail that people don't realize that this was this officer. This is the second time this has happened in a short amount of time. What was the results from the previous shooting?
The victim name, his name was Merrill Hatch, and from what I gather from the internet and other sources, the guy was mentally unstable, and he had a phone receiver in his hand, so he wasn't even armed. Officer Hurst fired an AR-15 at Merrill Hurst. I'm unsure of the details of that case, but Merrill Hurst was federally shot by officers. I think five was involved, including Officer Hurst. Merrill Hatch died. I think that's the most important part of it. You know, I think, and a testament to Officer Andrew Hurst's reputation, a little into, I don't know the man, you know, but from the details I hear from my son's case and from Merrill Hatch's case, is obviously this officer, you know, live in fear a lot. You know, he don't seem to be very in control of his emotions. I think would, you know, probably be something that you would need to be in control of to be an officer. You know, you can't respond to calls, you know, in fear, you know, because fear causes you to react. And that's what he does, clearly, is if he's in fear or he claims to be in fear, you know, that's all the officer has to say to not be indicted, is that they were in fear for their life, they fear for the lives of others, you know. In the case of my son, it's from what I gather from the DA and from the mayor and from the media, you know, there were two other officers on the scene. They never discharged their weapon, only Officer Hurst. So it's safe to say that the other two officers wasn't in fear for their lives. Only this man. You know.
Can you describe for our audience what an indictment would mean, Seth, and what that will mean for you and your family?
An indictment of an officer, from my understanding, because I'm new to all of this also, would mean that Officer Andrew Hurst would be found criminally negligent in the shooting of my son, Quantus Hayes, and that would mean that he would stand trial on whatever charges I think the DA would see forth to stand him for. The grand jury, in this case, the grand jury, they're not sequestered, so they have access to all media outlets, just like the general public would. They're asked not to, you know, participate in the news or watch or participate in social media sites and things of that nature, so not to taint the jury, but they're not sequestered, which means that they're not closed in or cut off from the world. Mm-hmm. They have access, they have home computers, they have cell phones, so they still are aware, you know. My son has been really demonized in the news and the media. You know, they don't even mention that he was shot without mentioning that, you know, he was a suspect in certain crimes, which is irrelevant at this point because he lost his life.
I want to tie back into the indictment and that the difference between other juries where they're closed off from information, that this is special in that those involved do have access, say, to this broadcast, to social media, to their friends and colleagues, and that's why it's so very important that people support and are vocal about that. Are there ways that communities can continue to show support for you, show support for changing scenarios so that things like this don't happen in the future?
At this point, I would like if Ms. Brayford would please answer that. This is all new to me, and I'm still in a grieving process, so everything that, to my understanding, is not as clear, you know, at this point. Ms. Rafer has a lot more experience in what needs to happen than I do, so I'll let her answer. Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say, I think that right now is a very good time for people not only to call the police commissioner, who is also our mayor, Ted Wheeler, but also contact the district attorney's office and demand an indictment in this case. All they have to do is reference our city's history of non-indictments. All we have to do is reference our city's history and lack of protocol as it pertains to settlements in regards to deadly shootings. The enforcement of protocol and policy that's supposed to be instituted because of judges' rulings on the COAB and the DOJ settlement with James Chassie. None of that has been enforced. And so we have a lacking leadership in our city government. And I'm thinking that because we do have a new mayor who's also the police commissioner, he's inherited that. And that is all a fact, but I think that he can show courageous leadership and integrity in fighting on behalf of the family and the citizens to, you know, basically find an indictment in this officer so that we can charge him with an instrument that will give us a public jury, a public trial process that shows us how this works. This past week, information came out about the grand jury trial for Michael Brown in Ferguson, and you can't get away from the, you know, the look of what's happening here. There's a child walking down the street. There's an officer saying that they're looking for a suspect, and then there's a loss of life that's found. But what we've just learned in that indictment that happened with Darren Wilson, in the grand jury, he did say that Michael Brown did not take his gun, show any threat besides his color and his size, that there was no kind of connection or engagement, and that he shot him just out of fear. Now, a lot of people, had they known that information, you know, 2 years ago, we wouldn't be called thugs or terrorists for protesting. And a lot of these children that have been murdered since then, they would probably have indictments and policies and you know, even special prosecutors showing up in these different states, because it shows accountability when you have local leaders that show that type of responsibility. That's what we need. We need people to demand that from our city council. Yesterday, they just shut down their proceedings. To me, it's not a coincidence that they put out the call for an emergency order to ban protests in their council chambers, that it happened the same week that we had Venus come in. She came in that Wednesday, March 1st, and immediately after, they had a press conference saying that they were going to institute this new ban on procedure. They've had weeks and months a very foul, loud noise and all kinds of disturbances. But you take the grieving family's commitment to getting on the record and dealing with this in a form of nonviolent direct action. You use that opportunity to shut down and to violate constitutional rights. And I don't think because the conversation hasn't been elevated to promote awareness about what happened to Kwanis. I think in our city, we basically institute the criminalization ahead of time. And so there's not been any kind of equal footing to look at all these realities. People aren't connecting the dots. And so we need people that understand what's happening to use their voices. We need organizations that stand up for social justice to make statements, to make bold statements, to ask and demand accountability. We're asking them to do opinion editorials. We're asking them to do public statements. We're asking them to contact media. But make a statement on behalf of this family. There's no way we can have thousands of feet on the ground here in Oregon for all the lives that have been lost across this country and not stick together and find out how to get justice for Kwanis Hayes.
Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, and at KBOO we are wondering about the history of St. Patrick, the man, the myth, and the unique holiday which bears his name. KBOO's Al Khan has more.
The man now known to us as St. Patrick was born to wealthy parents in England toward the end of the 4th century. At the age of 16, he was taken in a pirate raid and brought to Ireland, where he was put to work as a shepherd. Living a life of solitude, mostly outdoors, he turned to religion. After 6 years, he had a dream that God spoke to him, telling him to escape, which he managed to do. He returned to Britain, then went to France, where he entered a monastery. There he changed his name to Patrick from his birth name of Mowins the Saint. After 12 years of study, he became a bishop in the Catholic Church. At this time, he had another dream of God speaking to him, telling him to go back to Ireland and convert the pagans to the Catholic faith. Legend has it he combined the circle, which is the Celtic symbol for the sun, and the Christian cross, to form what we now call the Celtic cross. He also used the shamrock to explain the Holy Trinity. The shamrock was already considered holy in Ireland at this time, as the Irish Druids had many triple deities. With this familiar symbolism, he was able to make conversions in several important families. which allowed him to travel throughout Ireland, establishing many monasteries and schools. As his fame and power grew, he set his sights on the complete removal of all the pagan Druids. Those that would not convert, he had killed. High Druids at this time wore headbands with interwoven symbols that resembled serpents, thus the metaphor of driving the snakes from Ireland. The island was always free from actual snakes. Patrick died March 17 in the year 461, which is why he is celebrated on March 17th. Coincidentally, this falls during Lent, which allows Catholics a day of respite when they can eat and drink as they wish. The story and legend of St. Patrick has been celebrated in Ireland ever since. In America, the celebration of St. Patrick's Day started on March 17, 1762, when homesick Irish soldiers in the British Army held a parade in New York City featuring bagpipes and drums, helping them to connect to their homeland and finding solidarity with one another. The New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade is the longest annual running parade in U.S. history. Next, the potato famine came to Ireland, which drove almost 1 million of Irish immigrants to America. In Ireland, the preferred meat was smoked pork, as it was cheap there. However, in America, pork was expensive, but beef was less so. Irish immigrants were often the victims of prejudice and often lived in communities alongside Jewish people. So Irish people discovered corned beef, which was reminiscent of the smoked pork at home. And at this time, potatoes were still rare, as most potatoes had been previously grown in Ireland and shipped to America, and no longer available. But cabbage was inexpensive at this time, and boiling it with the corned beef gave the cabbage a nice flavor, so corned beef and cabbage was born. The common tradition of wearing green wasn't always so. In 1783, the Order of St. Patrick was established in Ireland as the senior order of chivalry in the kingdom. These knights wore the historic coat of arms of the Kingdom of Ireland, a gold harp upon a blue field. Thus at this time, blue was mostly associated with St. Patrick. In the later part of the 17th century, blue was supplanted by green, as green is one of the colors in the Irish flag, and also due to Ireland commonly being called the Emerald Isle. Today, St. Patrick's Day is celebrated across America with slogans such as, "Today, everyone is Irish," and "Kiss me, I'm Irish," and of course, with excessive alcohol consumption. So once again, as with Cinco de Mayo, we take a day of history and pride in another culture, and in the United States, we use this as just another reason to deny our sins of history and oppression of another people, and turn into nothing more than a night of seeing just how drunk you can get and how much of a fool you can make of yourself. If you cannot truly honor another culture without knowing the history, don't bother drinking. You have already made the fool of yourself. Engel Bra. I'm Al Khan with KBOO News, and I thank you for your attention.
That was KBOO's Al Khan with a history and commentary on St. Patrick.
And mil falce to everybody. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And then at 7, it's going to be Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Black and the African community here in Portland and beyond. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy all day with a 100% chance of rain. It'll be a high of about 50 and a low of about 49. Today in history, back in 597 BC, the Babylonians under King Nebuchadnezzar captured Jerusalem and plundered the first temple of Judaism. The Jewish king and thousands of his subjects were taken to Babylon, and they were subjected to a rather strict travel ban for the next 50 years. Today in 1968, United States soldiers killed as many as 504 men, women, and children in and around the village of My Lai during the Vietnam War. And in the year 1995, 130 years after the end of the Civil War, the state of Mississippi became the last state in the Union to formally ratify the 13th Amendment, which outlawed involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime.
It's 5:33. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Some people who attain high public office grow in their position of trust. Some, however, just bloat. Bloat has been on spectacular display in the first months of Donald Trump's presidential tenure. He had a disastrous start, choosing a cabinet and staff mostly made up of ideological quacks, incompetents, and Wall Street grifters. Yet, Buoyed by his explosive ego, President Trump pronounced his start historic. Quote, I don't think there's ever been a president elected who in this short period of time has done what we've done. Sadly, he's right. For example, they made a reckless, unconstitutional attempt to ban millions of Muslim immigrants from our land. They had to axe the kooky guy he chose to be his national security advisor. They've apparently been caught colluding with Russian meddlers in our politics. Some record. And now, Trump has embraced a GOP replacement of Obamacare, hailing the Trump Care substitute that will jack up our health care costs, cut benefits, and eliminate coverage entirely for millions of working class and poor people, while also sneaking in yet another underhanded tax cut for the rich. It's so awful that even hordes of Republican lawmakers have gagged, refusing to swallow it. Yet, lost in self-deception, Trump calls it wonderful. We have a president who is detached from reality, careening from one mess to another. But who will say the emperor has no clothes? He's so far gone that when he read his recent address to Congress straight off the teleprompter without his usual pugnacious ranting, Republican enablers of his antics and even the media establishment applauded him for being presidential. This is Jim Hightower saying, huh? The speech was a nasty wad of lies and right-wing nonsense. If the occasional appearance of sanity is all we ask of Trump, then his reign of insanity will be our fault.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Speaking before law enforcement officials in Richmond, Virginia, Attorney General Jeff Sessions reflected on his approach to drug use. Here's the quote. I think we have too much of a tolerance for drug use, psychologically, politically, morally. We need to say, as Nancy Reagan said, just say no. That's the end of that quote of a quote. Sessions invoked a phrase that was once central to President Ronald Reagan's 1980s war on drugs. He bemoaned in particular the growing acceptance of marijuana. Just say no was the slogan behind a public education campaign and aggressive policing and mandatory minimum prison sentencing. Called the zero tolerance approach, it drove crime rates down, but it also fueled a dramatic increase in the prison population. 35 years later, medical professionals say that the approach is superficial. It does not work with the target audience of teenagers. It is a form of denial. The most effective programs in use today are known as social influence interventions that stress interactions among young people and recognition of the factors that drive drug use.
Now we hear from the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. XPO Logistics is settling an unfair labor practices charge with the Teamsters over Georgia police illegally preventing Teamster organizers from leafleting XPO truckers about union rights. The Teamsters were on public, not private property, at the time. Here's an excerpt from police audio where Teamsters organizer Ben Spate is confronted by a Port Wentworth, Georgia cop called by the anti-union XPO Logistics Company.
And we're handing it to them just for a moment, and then they're taking off.
Okay, but we still got a small little technicality there.
Okay.
All right, this is the city of Port Wentworth. Okay,
right.
This is a city street.
Right.
Okay, and now if we have to bring out a city ordinance so we can show it to you that you can't do that and it's impeding the flow of traffic, you might want to reconsider.
Even if we're in the
else.
Public right-of-way right here?
Okay, now you want to keep going on now.
No, I just want to figure out where can we leaflet these drivers because we're in a public right-of-way right here.
By that time, there were at least three Port Wentworth, Georgia police cars on the scene. The cops were going to issue warning citations for the legally protected union leafleting when the Teamster organizer asked them another question. He wanted the officer's badge number.
No, just go.
I got a right to ask
what? We don't have a right to answer it, okay? Just get in your vehicle and leave.
Give me a badge number?
You know what? That's fine. Let me see your ID again. We'll settle this in court.
The union will continue to leaflet workers. The Teamsters say this settlement is a victory for the right of XPO truckers to organize.
strike is an overwhelming success at this point by way of building the union, building a sense of community. It's just a very good day for the labor movement at this point.
AFSCME Council 31's Ed Sadlowski on the three-day unfair labor practices strike against Rockford, Illinois public schools. 900 workers in three different AFSCME locals hit the picket lines Wednesday. Sadlowski says there's strong support from the Rockford Education Association for the striking school bus drivers, food service workers, and special ed paraprofessionals. At the bargaining table, the workers are seeking better wages and benefits. These workers make between just over $9 and $14 an hour.
Nutrition workers, approximately $11,000 per year, working every school day on average. Paraprofessionals, $14,000 annually. The bus drivers, about $16,000 annually. That's for a full school year. These are really starvation wages that people are being paid.
The UAW says a tentative new labor agreement has been reached at Caterpillar. The union says no details will be made public until UAW members at Caterpillar have a chance to review and to vote on whether or not to ratify the agreement.
Sponsored by Ironworkers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under events.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Baker's yeast has become yet another boon to society. Scientists from the Synthetic Yeast Project are almost done mapping a synthetic genome of baker's yeast. Baker's yeast is something that people have been using for about 5,000 years to make bread and make other things rise. The ability to create the code of life for yeast could potentially enable scientists to create other synthetic genomes. These could potentially pave the way for tailor-made drugs, for artificially designed human organs, for biofuel, and even for tailor-made complete organisms. In lieu of potential public fears, Jeff Barkey, a geneticist at New York University School of Medicine who is leading the project, states that the biggest concern, of course, is that people are worried that our goal is to make a synthetic human, a human powered by a synthetic genome. He goes on to say, and this is why we are very adamant that our application is for engineering of cells that could be used as therapies for humans, not to make an organism from it.
The big winner of Wednesday's election in the Netherlands, and now the largest party of the Dutch left for the first time, was Green Left, headed by 30-year-old Jesse Klaver, known to his supporters as the Josiah. With more than 95% of votes counted, the party formed 25 years ago by a merger of communists, pacifists, evangelicals, and radicals, boosted its MPs from 4 to 14. The Netherlands' youngest ever party leader, Klaver, took over Green Left's leadership in May 2015 and built a strong following on social media through small meetup events. Klaver has a Moroccan father and a mother of Indonesian descent. He said on polling day that the left's answer to the rise of the far right is to stand up for its ideals. His rallies were among the campaign's largest. His TV debates were also widely regarded as triumphs. In one debate watched by 1.6 million viewers, Klaver told his far right anti-Islam rival that it was not right-wing populism, not Muslim immigration that was undermining Dutch culture and traditions. Oh, that it was right-wing populism, not Muslim immigration, that was undermining Dutch culture and traditions.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. One teenager and one worker injured by Israeli army gunfire in separate incidents in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Seventeen-year-old Fatma Takatka was critically injured on Wednesday afternoon by Israeli soldiers' gunfire near the illegal Israeli settlement block of Gosh Etzion. The Israeli army announced that the troops opened fire at the teenager when she tried to run her car into Israeli soldiers manning a checkpoint at the entrance of the settlement located between the southern West Bank cities of Hebron and Bethlehem. Takatka, from the town of Beit Fajar near Bethlehem, sustained critical wounds and was moved to an Israeli hospital. Her family denied the army allegations and told local news that the incident is most likely to be a traffic accident. Earlier, Israeli soldiers shot and injured Wednesday morning a Palestinian worker near a military roadblock east of the West Bank city of Bethlehem while trying to enter occupied Jerusalem. The Palestinian Red Crescent said that soldiers shot Ahmed Radaida, 27, in his left thigh and later handed him to medics before he was moved to Beit Jala Governmental Hospital in Bethlehem, suffering moderate injury. Eyewitnesses said that Radaida was shot in Wadi al-Hummus area and was on his way to work in occupied Jerusalem. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded the Heshi refugee camp south of the West Bank city of Bethlehem and clashed with local youth, wounding 5 Palestinians, including one who suffered a head injury. The soldiers also searched homes and abducted a former political prisoner. One of the wounded Palestinians is the son of the governor of Jenin, Lieutenant Ibrahim Ramadan, who was shot after the soldiers fired many live rounds at the family's car. In the meantime, at least 37 Palestinian civilians were detained by Israeli troops during army invasions and home searches targeting West Bank communities on Wednesday at dawn. 11 of those detained were taken by Israeli troops during home searches in several areas of East Jerusalem. Home searches and abductions were also reported in Hebron City, Ramallah, Jenin, and Nablus, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, March 15th, 2017 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, also known as the AAP, has issued a policy on the egregious care of children in ICE detention centers. They are calling on the government to do more to protect vulnerable children from being re-traumatized. Joining us over the phone, we are speaking with Dr. Julie Linton from the AAP. Hello, Julie.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me tonight.
Our pleasure. When did the American Academy of Pediatrics begin investigating health issues in children inside detention centers?
Can you repeat that question?